Today's Taisho will be on case 73, Basso and the 100 negations. Engo's introduction. Preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. Hearing is non-learning and non-attaining. Preaching is non-preaching and not if preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. What use is there in preaching? If hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining, what use is there in hearing? But this non-preaching and non-hearing are worth something. You are listening to me now, preaching here. How can we escape that criticism? Those who have eyes see the following. A monk said to Ba Dai Shi, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations, tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Bashi said, today I am tired and cannot tell you. Ask Chizo about it. The monk asked Chizo, who said, why don't you ask the master? The monk said, he told me to ask you. Chizo said, today I have a headache and cannot tell you about it. Ask Brother Kai. The monk asked Brother Kai, who said, coming to this point, I don't understand. The monk told this to Ba Dai Shi, who said, Zhou's head is white, Kai's head is black. Secho's verse, Zhou's head is white, Kai's head is black. It defies understanding. Ba's horses trampled over the world. Rinzai wasn't such a daylight robber. Putting aside the four propositions, the 100 negations, you can only nod to yourself. So I really want to thank everybody for coming here today and sitting so deeply, really deep sitting here in our Zendo. And also online, everybody's sitting really deeply. This is so important. Thank you so much for doing such an excellent job. So Basso in this koan is Ma Tzu, ancestor horse, like old horse or ancestor horse. So when he talks about Ba's horses trampling the world, the editor means that Ma Tzu really, in some ways, created a Zen. You know, he was the one who, or one of the key figures who said, you know, it's not enough to commit yourself to an understanding of the sutras or the Vinaya. It has to be living practice. And his insistence on living practice really made Zen this engine of enlightenment for like 1,000 years, really. Basically, there were many forms of Buddhism in China when Zen arrived, and there were very elaborate teachings and big libraries and like the equivalent of monastic universities and lecture circuits. But so much of it was dead wood, right? So much of it was not alive. It was mostly commentary on other people's commentaries. And so what Ma Tzu did was to find a way to shatter that world, you could say, and created a form of practice, Zen, that insisted on doing something special. But what is that something special? And that the koan is kind of getting at this, right? I mean, when one way to look at life is to say that we are, that life is exhausting, because it's so chaotic. Right? Life is exhausting because it's so chaotic. And there's a lot in the world that seems that way, right? I mean, if you read the newspapers, and I hope you do, maybe for a limited period every day, you know, or if you read the news online, you know, almost every day there's something that is justifiably upsetting, right? I mean, you read it and you think, oh my God, can this be happening? Oh my God, can this be happening? And of course, next week we have a big event also. So, you know, it's possible to say that life is really chaotic. It's out of control. And you know, we feel helpless in the face of so much headlong change. And so, you know, it makes sense that we would want to create like a zone of security or a zone of stability, right? Like an island like a rock we can hold on to, right? And, you know, people try to create that. We try to create things that will be stable and predictable and controllable. And people do that in lots of ways. One of the ways they do that is by creating, you know, a field like literary scholarship. You know, so if you want to be an English professor, you get a bachelor's degree, and then you apply to a graduate program, and you pick a writer who died 500 years ago, John Milton, let's say, and you read everything John Milton wrote, and then you read everything ever written, you know, not literally, because it would take you your lifetime, but you really read all the big names in the field of John Milton studies. And then you try to add to that in some way by saying something somewhat original. That's such a human thing, right? So human to do this. I mean, first of all, I myself actually like John Milton. I think he's a great poet. You know, outside of English departments right now in the United States, I don't think there's 1,000 people reading John Milton. You know, and that's a country of 350 million people. You know, Milton is such a great poet. It makes so much sense to say, we can't just forget this guy. We need to hold on to him. And so, you know, basically Milton is required for all English majors at Rutgers. You have to read Shakespeare, you have to read Milton. And, you know, there's actually journals of Milton studies that are published, and really brilliant people write for the Journal of Milton Studies. And you read these articles and, you know, they bring everything into Milton studies, you know, physics, law. It's so ingenious. It's so beautiful, really. But you know, at some point you say, well, but, you know, not 1,000 people are reading Milton. Why are we doing this, right? And yet, you know, it makes sense, right? Because what we're doing is we're kind of like creating an island of stability in all this chaos, right? We're all working together and we're creating an island of stability. You know, there are so many novels get written every year. So many of them are really good. You know, I can't describe myself as an avid reader because I do other things. You know, whenever I can, I try to keep up, and it's impossible to keep up, right? It's just so much good writing. And the amount of writing is not decreasing, it's actually increasing. So, you know, as all this stuff is produced, you know, Milton is just pushed to the back and pushed to the back and pushed to the back. And it's a little frightening to think that Milton is going to someday just like, you'll say John Milton and people will say, who? That's already the case. You know, at one time, most houses in the United States had a copy of Paradise Lost by John Milton next to the Bible, right? So, you know, change is frightening, and, you know, it makes sense that we would try to stabilize things a little bit, hold on to, like, this island of stability. And I understand it because I love John Milton's poetry. Shakespeare, same way. You know, Shakespeare is like a super genius. You know, he's really great. I teach Shakespeare once a year at least, you know, and you know, whenever I teach his plays, I'm always like struck by how fascinating he is. He has all these women who become men and do things that men can't do in some of his plays, you know, and I often teach those plays, you know, because it's he has these gender non-conforming heroines, you know. Fascinating, right? But the language is so hard. It's so hard for my students to get through that language. You know, and I think the day is going to come when maybe we'll start using, like, translations of Shakespeare, you know, something like that. Because it's so hard for them. It's horrifying to think that the day might come when Shakespeare isn't read, right? And it's always wonderful when somebody makes a new Shakespeare, a movie with based on a Shakespeare play. That's just thrilling to me. But all the same, I know, you know, in a way, this is an island, right, of stability in a world of change, right? And it makes sense that people would do this, right? We see the world as chaotic, and we try to construct order, right? And this goes for our personal lives too, right? I mean, I have a friend who is bicontinental, and she's a professor, and, you know, for a long time she would be renting places in the city. She has a works at a university in the city, and she would be renting places in the city, and because she's often here only like 9 months of the year or 8 months of the year, she's back in East Asia. You know, she didn't want to take a long-term lease, so she would, you know, find people who were looking for, like, they had an apartment, but they wanted a roommate, right, or a suite mate or an apartment mate, somebody who could pick up some of the costs. And for years, my friend did this, you know, you know, think about how chaotic that is, you know, you know, eventually she bought a very nice condo. And now she has that stability. It makes so much sense that people would want to do that. You know, so it makes some sense for us to think about the world as like a chaotic, you know, this chaotic process. What we want to do is try to create an island of security and predictability, right? And you know, I'm 70 years old. So, you know, I'm very good at creating like an island of predictability. You know, I get up. You know, every day is like almost the same, right? I get up. I meditate. If I have to teach, I take a shower and get my lessons ready, and I go and drive in and teach. If I don't have to teach, I might, you know, go for a jog or walk or work out on the elliptical. And then I'll do my work all day. And around 5, maybe I'll take a little walk around the block. You know, I eat early, you know, maybe I'll meditate again. If I have great papers, I'm grading papers until I go to bed. We have the Zazen in the evenings. You know, when you create that island of comfort, it's that island of order. It's very comforting, very wonderful. We all do it. We kind of have to do it. But what often happens is two things often happen, right? I think. One of them is that if we're not very careful, you know, all the life drains out of our daily routine. You know, it's like, I know a lot of people. When I first started teaching, I'm an English teacher. When I first started teaching, it was terrifying to me. You know, I'm an introvert pretty much. And in the idea of standing in front of a room of people and talking and getting running the discussion for an hour and a half, that was so difficult. And I can remember my first couple of classes, I had a plan and I went in, and like my first class, I had, this was at a different university on the West Coast, so it wasn't 80 minutes, it was an hour. But like in 20 minutes, I'd used up all my stuff. And then I didn't have, it was like, now what do I do? It was terrifying, you know. So I had a couple of these classes and it was traumatizing for me. So, you know, I would hyper plan my classes, but it was always nerve wracking. Sometimes if I'd have a plan, and then if the class was deviating from the plan, I wouldn't know what to do. Should I stay with the plan? Should I go with this? And so teaching was nerve-wracking for me and frightening. And I didn't get good evaluations my first couple of semesters. So I really tried to be a good teacher, and I got really good at it. I think many people have this experience where they, you know, at first it's maybe frightening, and then it's actually interesting. It's like, you know, how do you make a class exciting? How do you make a class engaging? And lots of people go through a period, lots of teachers go through a period where they're really in it. They're really, you know, engaged, and they're reading things on pedagogy, and they're thinking, how can I bring this to life, you know? And you know, you have these days where it just doesn't click, and, you know, it's a challenge, right? It's like, how can, you know, next time I do that, I'm going to do that differently, right? And then, you know, you have these classes where it's like magic. It all comes together. People are talking. They come up with great ideas. It's like, ah, I've done it. You know, it's happening. But, you know, I know a lot of people who have been in this game for like 30 years, 35 years, 40 years even. And, you know, if they're honest with themselves, it's often just like going through the motions, right? It's like the same jokes, the same texts, you know. So you're teaching the same poetry you taught 10 years ago in your poetry class. And, you know, you're pretty much doing the same sort of shtick in each class. And what can happen if you're not careful is that all the energy drains away, right? This can happen in relationships too. You know, when you first meet somebody who's interesting to you, right? Maybe somebody you think, gee, this might be somebody I'd like to spend my life with. You know, it's like magic sometime, right? It's like this extraordinary encounter, right? And you know, then if you go forward with your relationship, there comes a moment where it, people say the magic is gone, the honeymoon is over. You know, that's very typical, right? That happens to pretty much everybody, right? And then you think, what do I do now? But, you know, this person you couldn't stop thinking about all your waking minutes, you know, suddenly you're sitting in a living room with that person, and you've been sitting in the living room with that person for 20 years. And it's just like the furniture, it's like sitting with your furniture, right? And you're the furniture for the other person, right? You know, just to even things up here, you know. So if you're not very careful, it's like you've got all the, you've got all the contingencies eliminated, right? But the energy drains away. The energy drains away. So that's a huge problem, and I think that's kind of what happened to Buddhism in China, you know? I think, you know, people, when Buddhism arrived in China from India, it was tremendously exciting for people. And they, you know, there was nothing like Buddhism in China. There's Taoism. Taoism is not really like Buddhism. And Confucianism is not at all like Buddhism. You know, Confucianism is, if I may say so, Confucianism is very much about this world, right? And not about shattering barriers and stepping through barriers and so on. Anyway, I think the Chinese just were in love with Buddhism. And they worked so hard to understand Buddhism. They, you know, did these brilliant translations. You had these Indian translators working with Chinese translators. And you had some real genius, Indian geniuses who worked with Chinese geniuses and did these incredible translations of the sutras. And they built monasteries and convents, and you had libraries. But you know, it's like the Milton dilemma, right? It's like great poet, but after 500 years, you know, he's not exactly news, front page news, right? And, you know, and then you get the commentaries on the commentaries on the commentaries. And even, even, you know, in meditative practice, if you have a early Buddhist perspective, you know, you can sit down on the cushion and say, okay, so now I'm going to go through the jhanas. You know, now I'm going through the first form, jhana of form. Now I'm going through the second jhana of form. Now I'm going through the third jhana. Now I'm going into the formless jhanas. Now I'm into the, basically being able to go through all the jhanas does not guarantee that you will wake up. But, you know, if you've been trained to go through the jhanas, right, you can go through the jhanas all day long, right? And you can even define that as your accomplishment, right? That I'm a master of the jhanas. You know, I can get into the fourth formless jhana in, a minute flat, you know? And I know the Diamond Sutra backwards and forwards, right? And I know every major commentary on the Diamond Sutra. If you read Red Pine's translation of the Diamond Sutra, by the way, I think Red Pine has read every Chinese commentary on the Diamond Sutra because he cites them in his text. You know, he'll tell you what some guy in the 7th century said about the Diamond Sutra, about this line in the Diamond Sutra. But of course, all of that all of that apparatus, which is designed to make enlightenment accessible. It's like there's a road that's been built to take you to enlightenment. Becomes an obstacle. Right, becomes, if you just think about the road, you get good at walking on the road, you never wake up. See, and something similar can happen in our lives, right? Where, you know, we have this experience that we may or may not have expected of falling in love, let's say, and it rocks our world, and it, you know, and then 25 years later, it's like, oh yeah, it's you again. Same face for breakfast. What do we talk about, right? You know, because we've talked about everything that we know, right? So the magic goes away, right? And one way to think about this koan is it's about that problem. We create these routines, and we have to, right? It would be crazy for you to start sleeping at a different time, you know, getting up at a different time. You know, if you're a teacher, you don't want to miss your classes. No matter what else happens in life, don't miss your classes. You don't want to lose your papers, right? So you know, a lot is expected of us, and so we need to be, you know, disciplined and have a schedule and so on. But it sort of cuts us off from the energy of life, actually, right? It cuts us off from the energy of life. And Buddhism, I think, in China, there was a danger at a certain point that it was beginning, instead of becoming this wonderful, magical process of liberation, it was becoming a closed door. People were becoming so obsessed with monastic ritual or with scholastic commentary that the immediate experience was gone. It was gone. And Zen came along. You know, there were many brilliant innovators in Chinese Buddhism, all struggling with this problem. But Zen came along and said, you know, anytime things disrupt your routine, that would be actually kind of like a good thing, right? Anytime you find yourself flailing in midair and you don't know what to do, that's actually kind of a good thing, right? And it's the thing we don't like, right? It's the thing we don't like, but it's actually essential if we want to wake up. So you know, one way to think about the world is that the world is a chaotic place, and we create these routines to have stability and peace and so on. But the other way to think about it is that the world is alive, is a lively place, that it's a complex, self-organizing system. And change is essential to its nature as a living system. But that we humans are uncomfortable with change, so we create these rigid routines to protect ourselves. But the cost, the price we pay, right, is cutting ourselves off from that vitality. So it's almost like the medicine we need is a little bit of chaos. Yeah, and I think we can see this, you know. I was just reading this article the other day about, you know, you can't get insurance in much of Florida, flood insurance. It's obvious why, right? Because in 100 years, much of Florida is going to be underwater. But, you know, they're still building big buildings in Miami Beach, even though it's going to be underwater in a century. Right. And even though the insurance companies know it, you know, if they could make money, they would make money. But they're not, because they know that the losses are going to be so astronomical. People can't change because they've invested so much in these routines. Right. They can't change. They can't, because the cost of starting up again is just so great for them. It's so frightening. Right. And you can fail. Right, you can fail. So if you're a builder, you know, you could try something else. You could go somewhere else, but you could fail. So far, it's been working in Miami. You just keep putting up these high rises and selling these condos for $3 million a piece, and you're raking in money. But in a century, it's all going to be underwater. So that's like a big example. But there's lots of little examples in our lives too. So, you know, what Zen does is, the secret of Zen is to, is basically to, like, pull the rug out from under you, to create a situation where you don't know, So, you know, every koan is similar in one respect, right? You don't know what the hell how you're going to answer this. And no background knowledge, you know, maybe a little background knowledge about the story, like I'm telling you about Master Ma, Who's Ma Tzu? What did he do? And so the context makes sense. But how to answer the koan, so to speak, how to respond to the koan is really it's like being pushed off a cliff. And you know, the whole idea of Zen training is the teacher just keeps pushing you off a cliff. And, you know, yeah, that's probably a good analogy, pushing you off a cliff. And, you know, for the longest time, it's terrifying to fall. You know, you might read all these books on Buddhism, and you saw Mr. Sakita's book on Zen training, and you read Mr. Sakita's bit. I put it on the book. It's useful. But when you have a koan, none of that helps. You know, you can go to the library and stuff, but you're forced into like this. It's just like falling off a cliff. You're forced into that chaos, right? That disorder. And for the longest time, it's a horrible feeling. You know, I ran track, you know, when I was in high school, but I was not an athlete. And there were all these handsome athletes in my high school, and I was not one of them. I was this scrawny little guy, and I ran track, but nobody cared. And, you know, I realized I'm good at something else. And it turns out I was good at, you know, like getting good grades. I was good at, you know, studying. And so, you know, that became my identity. Being a good student became my identity. And I would get awards for my grades. And every year I'd come home with a little trophy for a scholarship, you know. And my brother had athletic trophies, but I had trophies for scholarship, you know. It was really important for me to get grades, good grades. If I didn't get an A, I felt very disappointed in myself. And I really worked hard to make sure I always got A's. You know, when I started doing Zen, I started getting like F's, right, in Zen, right? I mean, when I started doing koan training, I interpreted it at an unconscious level, maybe, as like taking a test, right? We say you pass the koan. I wanted to pass the koan with an A+, right? But we would go to sesshin, and you know, at the end of sesshin, you as I've said, you really should never discuss your response to the roshi, to the teacher, with anybody else. And please don't. But in spite of that, you know, some of the hippies I trained with would all come back in their Volkswagen bus and talk about their koan answers. And I was one of those hippies, and I was on the bus coming home, and I would listen, and I would think, oh my God, all these people are answering their koans. And it became like a phobia for me, right? It was so hard for me to fail. You know, I couldn't quit Zen because on a deeper level, something about it was so liberating, right? You know, I had all of these other things going on in my life that were challenging. And when I would go into the Zen, we would go to the Zen center and sit in the morning. It was like freedom. But when I was working with the koans, I took that freedom away from myself, right? I made it like the academic routine. You know, I demanded that I get the right answer. So this went on for the longest time. I couldn't even answer the breath perception koan. I couldn't give a good response. It never occurred to me, why don't you just watch your breath and see what happens, you know? And years later, I realized, you know, many years later in my Zen practice, long after I wasn't working with breath perception, I realized, you know, the breath doesn't always come out your nose. You know, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're in deep samadhi, sometimes it feels like the breath is coming out your forehead. Or sometimes it feels like the breath is gone. Or sometimes the breath is bright, you know. And all of those are real experiences of the breath. You know, our book knowledge says, you know, that breath has to go in through your nose and or in through your mouth, and the O2 goes in and the CO2 goes, but that's not how we experience things, right? You know, when you sit on the cushion with an open mind and you watch your breath, you realize that breath is like a messenger from another world, right? It's like so amazing. You know, because, you know, you realize, first of all, I don't know what the breath is. I have no idea what the breath is. And if you start watching the breath with that attitude, you realize, oh my gosh, it's taking me to this place that feels so deep. Like the breath takes you to samadhi. It's like a messenger. It's like, come with me. You follow the breath, and after a while, you're in deep samadhi, right? And sometimes the breath, when you're in samadhi, it goes out your forehead. Sometimes it disappears. Sometimes it's like golden threads, right? That's all ways of experiencing the breath. I didn't permit myself to experience the breath because I wanted an A, right? So, you know, that so quote-unquote chaos that I was afraid of, that losing control, prevented me from experiencing the vitality of Zen practice. Not knowing was so frightening for me. Being wrong was so frightening for me. But, you know, after you're wrong 100 times, right, you begin to get used to it. Maybe it doesn't take 100, because I didn't, at that time, I had only done like 3 koans in about 4 years. But you know, I developed a tolerance for being wrong and a tolerance for not knowing. And when I developed that tolerance, you know, in spite of myself, you know, I began to just go with it. You know, just go with it. And, you know, it's like, as I said, years later, I was just watching my breath, and I never had passed that koan, really, you know. And then suddenly I realized, oh, my God, any of these would be a great answer. I could have gone into Genki Roshi and said, silver threads. Or I could have gone in and said, bright. Or I could have gone in and said, going out of my forehead. Any one of those answers, probably Genki would have said, oh, excellent, you know. But instead I did anything but look at my breath and play with my breath. I just didn't want to expose myself to the possibility of failure. And this is such a human thing, right? This is such a human thing. So, you know, I think this is what happened in China. You know, people, little by little, they built such an apparatus that enlightenment itself got lost or covered up, right? Buddhism is not about the jhanas. It's not about answering koans. It's not about robes. It's not about Buddha statues. It's about enlightenment. But enlightenment is only possible, you know, if you step away from these structures that we create to make ourselves at ease in the world, and we are willing to sort of like be pushed off a cliff. And, you know, the first 100 times you're pushed off a cliff, it's terrifying. But after a while, you realize this is really cool. You know, this is actually cool. You know, this is really like I'm outside of my comfort zone. I'm outside of my assumptions. You know, there aren't any rules for enlightenment. Actually, you know, this is one of Zen's big points, right? You know, all these different schools of Buddhism have like rules for enlightenment. And Zen calls itself the method of no method. And you could say, well, you have koans, you have sutra, you have lots of methods. But when you look at koans, it's the method of suddenly finding that no method works, right? You know, the brilliance of koans is that they push you off the cliff. And that's where the no method part comes in, right? And, you know, for the longest time, you might hate that experience. But eventually you realize this is so liberating. This is so freeing. You know, once you step off the cliff, you know, you realize so much of this was, why did I let myself get trapped by these stupid ideas, right? Why did I let myself get trapped by these stupid ideas? It's like when I was like, my father was in the military, and he found the counterculture deeply threatening. My father served two terms of service in Vietnam, for example, and I was incredible. When I was young, you know, when the Beatles came to the United States, you know, all my friends started growing long hair. My father thought this was an existential threat to the moral soundness of the country. So, you know, he would take my brother and me to the barber, and we would have these really short haircuts. And after the haircut, my brother would be so upset, he would start crying, and he'd run into the woods in shame. And we would have to get on the bus the next day with our short haircuts, and all the other kids looked like John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And, you know, I couldn't sleep. It was so upsetting to me, right? And, you know, then you realize, I mean, he shouldn't have done that. It was wrong. And he was a bully. But, you know, it's not as important as I thought it was. You know, 40 years later, it was the end of the world at that time. You know, now I don't even have any hair. You know what I mean? Or I'm losing the last bit of hair that I have. So I'm not minimizing it. But, you know, we all have these things that seemed like the end of when you were, you know, in elementary school. You know, if something happened to you at school, it was like the end of your life. And, you know, what Zen does is these things you think, if this happens, I just won't be able to endure it, right? And then it happens and you endure it. You go, oh, why did I worry about that? You know, all of these koans have these tricks or contradictions where it's like, what'll it be, this or that? And you think, oh my God, this or that, which will it be? Then you realize, I don't have to take either one. You know, I can, you know, it's so hard for us to be free because we're afraid, right? It's hard to be free. And the world is something we can't control, right? We can't control it. So I'm not saying you should quit your job and, you know, live on a beach in Hawaii tomorrow. Hold on to your apartment, you know, hold on to your house. But on the other hand, you know, we don't have to be prisoners of this mentality all the time. You know, we can hold on to your house, but free your mind from these obstacles, right? That's sort of how what Zen is about. So you know, this is a story about a monk who goes to Master Ma Tzu, and he says, you know, I'm a highly well-trained monk. I know Buddhist philosophy backwards and forwards, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations. Tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West, see? So he's like a prisoner. He's like so afraid. He's surrounded himself with all this knowledge to protect himself from not knowing. But not knowing is where it's at. As I hope people still say that. That's what we used to say. It's where it's at. And now, you know, when a monk asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? That's a Buddhist philosophical issue. Do animals have, and of course the answer is yes. Not only do animals have Buddha nature, they are Buddha nature. But Joshu doesn't say that, because if he said that, that's just another idea. When Joshu says mu, he says, now, sonny boy, I will show you how to be unknowing. I will show you how to jump off the cliff, mu. See, same thing here. This guy comes in and asks this question, and Matsu doesn't go, oh, well, it's like the four propositions say this, but this is the truth and this is not. He says, oh, I'm too tired to even talk about it today. Go ask Chizo. See, and Chizo says, go ask the master. Well, I already asked the master. He told me to ask you. Well, he says, I have a headache. And then he says, go ask Brother Kai. And Brother Kai goes, I haven't a clue. I'm as clueless as you are. So, you know, it's like everywhere he goes for the answer, he's thwarted. He's blocked. It's like every step he knows less and less about what to do. And, you know, at some point he's going to sit down on the cushion and he's going to go into deep mushin. And he's just going to stay in that state of not knowing until something begins to stir, right? It's like you have this deeper intelligence that is deeper than knowledge and deeper than certainty. And it's the part of your awareness that is in sync with that energy that looks chaotic if we cling to our ideas. But it's, you know, when you are with that mind, you are swimming, you know, that you're swimming in that sea of energy freely. And when we sit down on the cushion and we go into deep mushin, sooner or later we make contact with that intelligence. And then it presents us with something we didn't imagine in a million years. So the monk is on the path. He doesn't know it yet. But everybody's thwarting him and not giving him an answer. And every time that happens, he's going deeper and deeper into reality. Okay. So preaching is not introduction. Preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching. Hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining. If preaching is non-preaching and non-teaching, what's the use of preaching? If hearing is non-hearing and non-attaining, what's the use of hearing? But this non-preaching and non-hearing are worth something. If you are listening to me now preaching here, how can we escape this criticism? And the way we escape this criticism is to make a big mess and leave everybody confused, see. That's what koans do. They open a door and you go through the door and you find you're falling off a cliff. How wonderful. A monk said to Matsu, Ma Daishi is great teacher. Okay. To Ma Daishi, independent of the four propositions and transcending the 100 negations, tell me plainly the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. Ba, she said, oh, I'm tired, I can't tell you. Not today. Ask Chizo about it. The monk went to Chizo. He said, didn't you ask the master? The monk said, he told me to tell you. Well, I have a headache. Ask Brother Kai. The monk went to Brother Kai, who said, I don't know. I'm clueless. The monk told this to Ba Daishi, who said, ah, Zo's head is white, Kai's head is black. Secho's verse, Zo's head is white, Kai's head is black. It defies understanding. Master, ancestor, horse, his horses trampled the world. In other words, those Zen masters, they They threw dust in everybody's eyes, and that's how you become enlightened. Rinzai wasn't such a daylight robber. In other words, even Rinzai, you know, really just was carrying out Ma's method. Putting aside the four propositions, the 100 negations, you can only nod to yourself.